Hi, I'm Tim Peter, and welcome to Search Chat, Solo Segment's podcast dedicated to all things search, AI, and content marketing related. Who is Solo Segment? Well, we're a technology company focused on site search analytics and AI-driven content discovery to improve search results, increase customer satisfaction, and unlock revenue for your company. Solo Segment, make your search smarter. You can learn more at solosegment.com. In this episode of Search Chat, Solo Segment CEO Steve Zaker and I talk about Andreessen Horowitz and the empty promise of data moats. We also look at the counterarguments that explains why data may in fact be a moat and how you make data work for your brand and business. Finally, we give some great examples of how people are doing that in the real world every single day. All that and more coming at you on Search Chat right now. Steve, how are you doing today?
I am doing really well. I'm very happy not to be sitting in a car today. I had one of those days yesterday where I was, driving to Boston, took a couple calls on the way to Boston, had meetings in Boston, had dinner in Hartford, and then back home. So it was a busy day. Lots of good conversations and some good business being done. But at the same time, time in the car is, well, I guess better than time in a plane. Maybe I'll leave it at that.
Sure. But not just road warrior in this case, but the I-95 warrior.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Good times.
Well, that's fantastic. Well, great talking with you as ever. I think we've got some really cool stuff this week. And I want to start with this really interesting post that was written over on A16Z. So this is Andreessen Horowitz's blog specifically, and they're talking about people have long referred to data as a moat. So this is Martin Casado and Peter Lawton writing at Andreessen Horowitz, A16Z.com. And they really make the case that data is not a moat. They call it the empty promise of data moats. And I'm going to read just a little tiny piece of this where they say, data has long been lauded as a competitive moat for companies. Mm-hmm. And they say, but for enterprise startups, which is where we focus, we now wonder if there's practical evidence of data network effects at all. Moreover, we suspect that even the more straightforward data scale effect has limited value as a defensive strategy for many companies. And this is a thing that we have talked about more than once, both here on the show and, when we're actually just, talking about work.
Yes.
And I'd love to get your take on it. First and foremost, is data a moat or not? And if in either case, why or why not? Right.
Well, first of all, let's define what a moat is.
All
right. If a moat is an uncrossable chasm, then data is not a moat. If we think about data as an inconvenience to climbing the walls of competition, maybe. And I think it's usually shorter term defensibility. But I tend to agree with what they're saying in this article that there is very little data today that a company can capture that other companies aren't capturing. And by the way, who doesn't buy third-party data to augment their first-party data, right? So, it's a very large industry that allows you to do that on almost, pick your industry, pick your topic, and you can buy third-party data about it. And if you can't, you can do primary research to gather that third party. I think the days when data really was defensible, and we'll talk about D&B, I think, in a little bit, but where it really was a defense, where you had kind of just in having the data and being able to bring the data into a single repository so that it can be useful, I think those days are over. I think those days are over because, first of all, the inventory of data is, available, at many, many vendors. So that's there's not a lot of scarcity, if you will, around data itself. And I also think that the mechanisms by which data can be aggregated and matched and whatnot, a lot of that, what used to be the application layer, where you really had to go off and create something unique to bring together data sets, a lot of that has commoditized and become platform that you can get off of AWS or, you know, download it from some Git or whatever, right? So it's a lot of that stuff has become, application layer has become kind of platform layer, if you will. And so I think at least for those two reasons, you know, data isn't a moat. But that said, if you think about the moat in terms of filled with alligators and water and kind of slowing down the attacker, I think in the short term, especially if it's first party unique data, it might give you some, you know, kind of first mover advantage. But I think as soon as the market figures out that, oh, they're just using X data or combining X data with Y data, and the market's pretty good at sussing that out, because if nothing else, they'll hire your engineers. The advantage is going to very quickly be eaten away. And so I think the data of itself as a differentiator is not the game, right? The game is, what are you doing with the data? You know, platform versus application layer, I guess, is the way I think of it from a technical perspective.
Right. And actually, I want you to expand on that for just a moment. But you and I were talking before the show, and I've kind of repurposed a metaphor other people have come up with. This is not my original idea by any stretch. But, you know, I like this concept of data is like oil, and not in the sense that most people mean it, but in the sense of, you know, it's something that makes the engine run, right? Data is not a moat in and of itself, but it can be a moat for you to cross if you don't have data, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you have to have some data before you can build those application layers and things along those lines. But it, in and of itself, it doesn't have tons of value if you don't do something useful with it. So I'd love you to expand on that just a little bit. You know, when you talk about the application layer is what makes the data interesting or makes it potentially a moat, you know, what does that look like, and what should people be doing there?
Yeah, well,
or how should they be thinking about it?
Yeah, so I mean, one of our products is probably a great example of that. You know, when you look at our search analytics product, Searchbox, the original vision of Searchbox is that it was pure analytics, and by the way, it works like any other analytics package works, right? You put a piece of JavaScript on your website, it collects data. And so that data begins to accumulate. And if you look at the data that we're accumulating versus the data Adobe accumulates versus the data Google, I mean, pick your analytics package. All those bits and bytes are aggregating in the same way into a database, right? It's page loads. It's all the, you know, what's going on in the browser and the mouse over events and the scrolling. All that stuff is just, so it's no longer, that data is a perfect example of, there's nothing special about it. Now, was it special back in 1999, early 2000, when a company called Keylime Software came up with this idea that, hey, maybe we should put a single pixel. That's what they called it back then, right? A single pixel thing, right? Yeah. You know? So yeah, that was an aha moment in this. So they had, for a very, very short period of time, a unique way of gathering data, right? Because back then it was, you know, you went through log files to figure out what's going on in your website. And they figured out, oh no, this JavaScript thing or this single pixel technology, that would be innovative and bring real value in the marketplace. But that has commoditized. And not only has that method commoditized, right, but it is the data that it captures has commoditized. And so no longer is anybody differentiating about how they present page views or visitor counts or whatever. That's not differentiated. And so, so I don't want this to be a commercial about our product not being differentiated, because—
Go right ahead.
Right, because where we do differentiate, and by the way, where everybody differentiates is somewhere beyond the data layer. So it is actually in the application layer. So what are you doing with that data? What is the unique kind of point of view and technology that you bring to the table to make your data more meaningful? And so if you look at what we do, you know, yes, everybody captures no results and most people capture clicks, but we capture this other set of behaviors that allow us to identify failed searches. And by, of course, mathematical properties, the inverse being successful searches. But we look at that set of data in a very unique way that allows us to identify those successful behaviors. And that's how we differentiate. And so that's one example of, I think, of how, you know, companies need to certainly be thinking about the data layer. But again, I don't think it is a persistent or a durable differentiator in the long run, because there's no patent, there's no IP that protects the ability to gather most sorts of data out there in the marketplace.
Well, and the data that, you know, even the data that you get as a proprietary data, which, I mean, we would not only argue that you should, we would absolutely argue that you must, you know, collect, you know, your competitors are collecting comparable data. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be exactly the same. It's not going to necessarily tell the exact same story, but it's going to tell them a useful story, just as you collecting your data should tell you a useful story, yeah. Right?
Last night I was having dinner with somebody in a large personal lines. I was in Hartford, right, where all the personal lines insurance mm-hmm. companies are. But I was having mm-hmm. dinner with them, and it reminded me of some discussions I had previously with a company. And this is one of these companies that's well known. They have their ads on TVs. And one of their ads a couple of years ago was, we're going to show you the quotes for what you would pay us for your insurance and what all of our competitors would charge you for that same insurance,
oh, sure.
Right?
Sure.
And
yep.
Was it because this company had a unique set of data that allowed them to do that? Because, of course, their point of view was, we're really good at underwriting and assessing risk. And so therefore, mm-hmm. if somebody else is going to charge you less, they're taking more risk than they should. We're happy for you to go do business with
right.
them, because they're going to go right. out of business quicker because we're better at it than they are, right?
Right.
And that was
right.
their whole premise. Right. It wasn't that they had better data, because everybody has the same underwriting data. We know
of
how
course.
Many accidents yeah. you've been in, how old you are, you know, all that stuff, what your health condition is. All these insurance companies have that data. But what they had is, in the application layer, they had a better technology for evaluating and pricing risk. So
yeah,
that's just another yeah. example of where differentiating yourself on the data that you gather is very, very difficult. Now, it could be that this company was, you know, had identified some piece of data somewhere that was relatively unique, but eventually somebody's going to figure that out, right? That's they probably got it from some consultant.
Oh, yeah.
And their competitors are going to hire that same consultant, and there you go. Now their competitors have the same piece of data. So it really is in what they're doing with the data that allowed them to differentiate their underwriting process, differentiate their quoting process, and with confidence be able to sell, yes, you should go buy from Allstate instead of us, because they're going to write a bad policy from their perspective and they're going to go out of business sooner. So it's
right, sort of right. Thing. Well, and even if, I mean, yes, everything you just said is absolutely correct. But even if it is something where, you know what, maybe Allstate's financials are set up differently that they can service that customer more effectively, more efficiently, mm-hmm. whatever. It was irrelevant. What they were saying was, this is a customer that is not a good customer for us. Yes. So we're happy to have them go somewhere else. Even if, you know, even if, again, that customer is a good customer for somebody else, let them have them. Not our customer, not our benefit
right.
to have them.
Right.
Right. Well, it sounds like you're kind of mirroring. There was a counter argument to this A16Z article. And you know, I want to be really clear. It sounds like we're agreeing with the A16Z article, mm-hmm. but also, you know, it's interesting, the counter argument, because I think we also agree with this. This guy, Alex Iskold on Twitter, in replying to the empty promise of data moats, did say that there are three examples that are interesting. A, massive databases. B, real-time response. And see hyper-personalized experiences.
Interesting.
And, you know, those are kind of interesting. I thought it might be kind of interesting for folks to hear why you think they're interesting.
Yeah. This notion of the massive database, right? And this is interesting. He cites some of the examples are, you know, kind of medical history databases. Real-time
yeah.
data sets like Waze has. And, you know, I do think that there are some situations where data is an advantage. And by the way, maybe a defensible. I mean, like Waze. Who's competing with Waze these days? I mean, I don't know anybody. Right. Now, I got to tell you, on my trip yesterday coming back from Boston, I don't know why I started the trip. Oh, I do know why I started the trip. I started the trip using Apple. And the reason I started the trip using Apple was for some reason Waze wouldn't find the Starbucks I wanted to go to. So I used Apple's map to get me there. And at one point later in the day, I had both Apple and Waze running at the same time. And what was really odd was I heard Apple's voice telling me about Waze's map, which was kind of strange. But regardless, you know, during that trip back, you know, it was clear to me that, you know, again, both massive databases, both collecting real-time data. So when you think of like traffic data, you know, they're measuring constantly how our cell phones moving through the environment. They're gathering other data to bring it in to understand, oh, there's a slowdown on I-84, you know, take, 191 and go around it or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. And they both made that recommendation. So, you know, here's two competitors, and Google probably does the same thing. So here's three companies that these are massive real-time databases. And I would argue, you know what? Waze doesn't have a super defensible market position there because these other competitors do. Now, where Waze does somewhat differentiate itself is all that social stuff. Oh, there's a pothole here. Oh, there's a police trap over there, right? So that's where I think Waze does differentiate itself. So I'm not sure it's a perfect example of that sort of situation.
Well, actually, what they do, I mean, obviously, you know, Waze is owned by Google, and what they do that's very interesting, and it does speak to what you're talking about, is the reason Google maintains Google Maps and Waze as separate apps is because they're each optimized for different use cases. You know, if you think about Waze, Waze only works if you're in the car, right? I mean, they don't offer walking directions. They don't offer transit directions. Mm-hmm. Waze is optimized to be the GPS replacement, whereas Google Maps is optimized to be, okay, how do you get from point A to point B?
Very handy, regardless of how you get when you're there, trying to figure out what subway.
Right, right. But if you're driving, Waze is a far better experience. Yes. So that the differentiator, to your point, is very much around that application layer of what is the use case, who is the customer in this case, and you know, oh, you're a driver, you want Waze. Oh, you're looking for multimodal transportation. You know, I've got to walk somewhere and also get a subway, or, you know, I'm going to drive partway and then I got to walk. Google Maps is going to be a better option for you because that's what it's designed to do from the ground up. But they are relying on actually very much the same data set and then differentiating on the application layer.
You know, it's interesting though, when you think about this and Alex's statement about massive databases, and I referred to D&B, Dun & Bradstreet, earlier. You know, if you go back even 15 years, there were no alternatives to Dun & Bradstreet, no viable alternatives.
Right.
I mean, they were the game, whether for companies looking for information about companies. They were the game. And you could tell that there were no viable alternatives because they exhibited kind of monopoly behavior. Like, for example, their product was hard to use. It had all these hierarchies and relationships between data that, it was clear that they were the big dog. And, you know, and maybe in a pre-digital world, even in a kind of, digital 1.0 world, that was defensible. But when you look at the power of company information has moved from the data layer to the application layer. And, you know, every website that wants to do real-time personalization based upon, say, the industry that you're in or the company that you work for or whatever, well, they're not using a Dun & Bradstreet product anymore. They're using Demandbase or Clearbit, right? And I'm sure D&B is in that business, but they're not the top name that you see in the Gartner quadrant, right? It's going to be companies like Demandbase and Clearbit. And these are companies where, you know, I got to tell you, I'm sure somebody at D&B regrets not being the Demandbase or Clearbit of this new world. And so that's an indication of where data in the past might have been a moat. It may even have been a wall, right? A big stone wall. But I think today we're seeing that that data has commoditized or is relatively easy to replicate. And so, you know, Demandbase's strength is not really in its data. It's in the fact that it moved first. that it's got a really great integration layer and ability to deliver this data in ways that are useful to people and to applications. And that, again, is the differentiator. It's in the doing, in the execution, and not in the gathering of the information.
So that's a great transition, because you and I talked about two different examples that have been announced in the last, week or so that really, show what you're mm-hmm. talking about in practice. And one is very much a B2C, I shouldn't say entirely B2C play, but it's, business to user mm-hmm. anyway, right? If not consumer, they're talking to an individual person, whereas the other is very much a B2B for small business specifically. So I just thought it'd be fun to get your take on each of these, separately. The first is Word is now incorporating AI-based features to help improve writing within mm. Word. So why don't we talk about that one first, and then we'll go to the second one, if that's okay.
As we've rolled out machine learning-based products over the past year or so, one of the things mm-hmm. I've realized is all data is training data. And, so as I saw this new feature that's in Word, in Microsoft Word, I said, Bob, that's really handy. I get that that's useful. I mean, for me, Google came out with a month or two ago, maybe it's a little bit longer than that, but a month or two ago, they kind of do a type ahead as you're typing emails. And this thing mm-hmm. is smart, right? I find myself accepting almost every recommendation. And by the way, when I do a word change, it seems to learn that word change, so it gets better. Mm-hmm. So the first thing I thought is, oh, this is brilliant. This is some great training data that Microsoft's getting as it makes recommendations. It's going to get better at making recommendations, and they're probably using this data elsewhere in their stack to make Bing smarter or maybe come up with a new product. But mm-hmm. regardless, mm-hmm. I think this is really fascinating. If for no other reason, yes, people will be better writers because of it, so that's good. But the other thing I really dig about it is the fact that it gives everyday humans exposure to how machine learning makes life better. Text analytics makes life better for us all, right? It is mm-hmm. Kind of mm-hmm. a very practical and visible example of that. And I got to tell you, I talked to a lot of marketing execs. Yesterday was my 103rd conversation, not that I keep track or anything, but my 103rd conversation with a marketing exec this year. And, they all struggle. Like, they've learned the buzzword bingo. They know some of the stuff that works for them, but they're still kind of wondering, how does this all work? And I love when something very practical like this appears, because it shows humans how it works. And I think it kind of mm-hmm. fosters in business, because that's where the leadership needs to come from. It fosters in business I get how this might work now in some other context that might be a context that's not said by the most recent sales rep who sat at their desk. So yeah, I dig this. Mm-hmm. I think this is very, very cool. I've loved Google's kind of version of this. The Word version seems much more sophisticated. And if for no other reason, hey, everybody's going to be a better writer. That can't be a bad thing.
That's great. Yeah, exactly. Maybe we'll see better written emails and things like that. So the other one that I thought was really interesting, and by the way, I love your point about showing it in the real world. I as much like you, I have conversations with, probably a couple hundred folks over the course of this year where literally people say, yeah, but, is this real or is this just hype or something buzz that's not really going to go anywhere? And so it is great when you can point to these examples of, no, this is real, and here's a very real practical example.
What would be wonderful, we have a new product called Guidebox, and when I try to describe how that works to people, and it is, you know this, but I'll, for our listening audience, what it's looking for is mm-hmm. patterns in visitor behavior, and then it's making content recommendations. And boy, if everybody were using this Microsoft Word thing, it would be great to say, oh, how Word figures out that the paragraph should be worded like this, or that instead of talking about this topic, you should be talking about that topic. You know how that works? Oh, well, this works the same way. And people will go, oh, yeah, I get that. But sometimes when I talk to folks who are less technically savvy or kind of haven't read up to it, I really have to step back to C-spot run sort of language to, you know, to talk it through. And, right. And I'm happy to, because I want, A, I want to sell them something, but B, I want them to understand how AI can be practical. And again, I think this is going to be a boon for that.
Absolutely. Well, so the other one that I thought was interesting, this B2B one that I thought was really interesting, people probably remember a year ago, Google introduced its AI that could go ahead and call restaurants for you, or call, you know,
I think hair salons
for you and make a point.
Right.
So what they've done now is they've taken that AI, that same technology, and they've turned it the other way around. It's called CallJoy, and it's actually designed to allow small businesses specifically to, instead of place those calls, answer those calls.
My phone's going to talk to your phone.
Right, exactly. I'll have my phone get in touch with your phone and we'll do something. But I think it does build on what you were just talking about. So again, I just love, you know, your take on this and its potential meaning.
I mean, you know, when I first saw Google's tech, and it literally has very specific use cases. I think there are three now, but making a hair appointment, which I don't have to do all that often anymore, but making a hair appointment was one of the big use cases. And I thought that was kind of neat. I mean, it was a good kind of practical way of getting people to understand the technology, because it's something we all do. And that's pretty cool that they have a use case that everybody can kind of connect with. So, you know, again, I think that this now, from that was kind of the consumer version. Now you flip it around and you say, you know, because again, if I'm the hair salon owner, now I'm thinking, wait a minute, I might be talking to a computer, and oh, that's kind of awful. And I just might feel a little weird about that. But now there's a technology for me, right? So that I can kind of be more productive and have a better, more consistent customer experience. Yeah. And somebody who's not going to get annoyed the third time a customer reschedules, right? So there you go. This is a win for all those reasons. But again, I think it all comes back to the more that we can make, as technology leaders, the more we can make this technology visible and in very practical ways, I think the more trust there will be in the technology in more sophisticated ways and ways that we don't understand. Because while I applaud Watson and IBM for starting to try to cure cancer, the doctor-patient relationship is one of the most intimate things out there. And,
of course.
You know, yeah, I want the best information in the world, but I don't pick the doctor with the best library, right? I pick the doctor who has demonstrated clinical expertise. And that's the kind of doctor I want to go to. And so I don't, you know, it's hard for me to trust. I might be interested in that technology. If it cures me, I might then build the trust. But, you know, it's kind of a weird place to start with, let the computer, let the computer, you know, assist in life and death decisions. It's like, why don't we start with scheduling a haircut? Let's start there.
And if
that works out good, you know, then we can, turn over, you know, kind of more complex things. As long as they don't become sentient and take over the world.
Absolutely. I mean, there's no argument here on that one. But what I also think is really interesting is it brings us full circle when we talk about these two examples, you know, the Word example and the Google example, in that in neither case, so far as I'm aware, are they really relying heavily on your data in the first case, right? I mean, it's not CallJoy needs to hear all your phone calls before it figures out how to work. And it's not, you know, Word has to analyze all of your writing. Yeah. In either case, I think it learns from yours, but it starts with, hey, these are use cases we see all the time. And the data that Google has collected, the data that Microsoft has collected, provide plenty of guidance to say, okay, here's how we improve on what exists right now. And again, you know, delivered at the application layer.
Yeah. No, I think that's a really interesting point. And, you know, it's interesting bringing that kind of home. You know, it's one of the reasons like Google search works so well is because it doesn't need, you know, this company's specific data to be able to, because it knows the patterns, right?
It
knows the, you know, it's got 80 bazillion pages in its index. And it's quite frankly, one of the reasons site search is so hard, because that does rely upon your data.
Right.
It's a very specific use case.
Well, and notice Google got out of the business of site search.
Well, exactly. Right?
Google went, search is tough when it's this kind of search. We're not going to do that.
Yes. Yeah. Moving on. But yeah, no, it is interesting that, you know, where you have the opportunity to use those massive data sets, boy, this is back to another thread in this, you know, that might be, I don't think it's defensible, but, you know, again, there's probably a moat that makes it more difficult in that situation. So I think we've argued both sides of the massive data set. Yeah, it could be or could not be a moat, but boy, I guess like most things in life, it depends.
Spoken like a true consultant, Steve.
With a deeply unsatisfying statement to end this.
No, I think you've made a couple of more than bold statements throughout, and I think given where we are, this is probably a good time to wrap. But I just wanted to give you a chance to get the last word. You know, anything you'd tell people about thinking about data and how they use it as a moat for their business, or more importantly, the application layer.
Yeah, and that's it. And that's just it, right? It is, what are you doing with the data to make it, you know, make the application of that unique and defensible? And, you know, when I talk to people about how we think about search success, that drives all our decision-making about data. It's not only do we want a good predictor of success, but I want to be able to do it in ways that other people can't copy. And so,
right. You know,
that's part of what we do, is we look for that success, but we look for it in very unique ways. And so I think any business, no matter what industry you're in, if you're thinking about creating a defensible business model, you can start with some data, but in the long run, it really is going to be, what do you do with that data? How do you bring it to the market in a unique and defensible way? And that's really the key to kind of competitive success.
Perfect place to stop, Steve, as ever. Well, great talking with you again. I'll look forward to our next discussion and catch up with you next time.
Thanks very much, Tim.
All right. Bye now. Search Chat is brought to you by Solo Segment. Solo Segment is a technology company focused on site search analytics and AI-driven content discovery to improve search results, increase customer satisfaction, and unlock revenue for your company. Solo Segment, make your search smarter, and learn more at solosegment.com. If you like what you've heard today, click on the subscribe links you can find at solosegment.com/podcast, on iTunes, Google Podcasts, Stitcher Radio, Spotify, or wherever fine podcasts can be found. You can also find us on LinkedIn at linkedin.com/company/solosegment, on Facebook at facebook.com/solosegment, on Twitter using the Twitter handle @solosegment, or you can drop us an email at info@solosegment.com. Again, that's info@solosegment.com. For Search Chat, I'm Tim Peter. I hope you have a great rest of the week. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll look forward to chatting with you next time here on Search Chat. Until then, take care, everybody.